After analyzing the risk and benefit, right, and also the cost of keep delaying the study, this study costed us like $7 to $8 million. And it was a very hard decision because we have a limited timeline. All of a sudden, we got product issues. I have to build the right team at the right stage.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm Jeff Holman. I'm your host. I'm an attorney with Intellectual Strategies, and I get the opportunity to fortunately work with a lot of people who are making big decisions. I get to see what happens behind closed doors. And I like to bring some of these similar types of situations and insights to the audience by speaking with really smart and successful people like Yikai Lo that we have on today. Yikai, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, for inviting me. It's my pleasure to join your podcast and to share some of my experiences.
It's fantastic. I've been excited to talk to you since I first since we first interacted. You were talking about being in the middle of doing a product. Well, you'll be able to explain it better than me, but my take on it was Yikai is really busy. His team has gotten some certifications on their medical device product in Europe. They're trying to get it in the U.S., and then when we started scheduling, I think we actually might have had to reschedule once because you, in fact, got the certification. You got the FDA approvals and had to do some meetings and things around that. So congratulations on that. That's very exciting.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. I think there's a hard work of our team, right? Kind of spent almost 8 years to find that we're able to, you know, not only have our product launched in the EU, but also bring it back to the U.S.
Yeah, medical devices are, that's not usually a very fast development process. So congratulations on that. And your company is Anuvo, right? Why don't you give us just a little bit of a background about what Anuvo does? And you probably have all the background because I think you started Anuvo from the beginning, right?
Yes. So, Anuvo is a company that I founded with my PhD advisor around 8 years ago. Okay, So it's a spin-off company from UCLA. So at that time, what I was planning to do is either find a faculty job or found a company by myself.
Okay, yeah.
And then I tried, and after seeing how my advisor, you know, needs to spend years training students, after 4 years, student graduated and need to return again another batch of people, I kind of feel like this is now something I will enjoy. And then I make a decision to, you know, found this company. So at Anuvo, we are developing bioelectronic medicine. So instead of using drug, right, or pharmaceutical approach to treat patients, we are developing a medical product that use electricity to treat or, you know, injuries or diseases that cannot be cured by conventional medical approaches.
Yeah. How does that, at a really high level, I have a little bit of an engineering background, but not a PhD level. At a high level, for those of us who aren't in that field, how does that work? How do you use electricity to, you know, fix injuries?
Right. So, I can use no spinal cord injury, the indication we are working on right now, as example.
Okay.
So for individuals with spinal cord injury, right? So they might lose because of the lesion, right? Spinal cord injury, you know, the lesion, the signal from the brain probably cannot effectively be transmitted to the spinal cord below the lesion.
Oh, okay. So it's almost like where you've got the nervous system, it has a disconnect or is severed or something. Okay.
Right. But although clinically, right, these individuals with SCI might have a complete spinal cord injury, but anatomically, there are still connections, you know, connecting below and above the lesion. So what we are doing is we are using electricity, right, to stimulate or activate the neurons to help the brain signal, right, to facilitate the communication below and above the lesion so the users or the patients can regain or improve their voluntary motor control.
That's fascinating. Would this, and you're talking about lesions, would this work with something that was similar to like a pinched nerve too, where you could bridge that pinch, or is it more just lesions?
So for pinched nerve, I got pinched nerve a couple of times per year because because I work for long hours, then I develop pinch nerve probably at least one or two times per year. Okay. So to my understanding, pinch nerve is more like, you know, some mechanical stress, right? Apply on, you know, to your nerve, right? It's different from the lesion. So for spinal cord injury, it's more like due to, especially for traumatic spinal cord injury, that is due to, likely due to a car accident, violence, you know, something like that, right? It's a physical damage to the cord or the nerves.
Something more dramatic. Well, I asked, and this is not the purpose of our conversation today, but as you're describing that, I asked because a year ago, I was playing soccer and I had a really weird experience where apparently between like T9 and T10 in my spine, you've got your radial, you know, nerves that come out of your spine and wrap around your body to about the lower rib cage.
Yeah.
And I had I have a pinched nerve there that has resulted in the left side of my abdomen being numb for the last year. And so when you're describing this, I'm thinking, you know, I'm waiting for this to get better. I've seen some doctors and it just like there's a real application for this. My situation is very trivial because I can live with it. It doesn't impede anything I do. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't impact the movement or sensations in my limbs. Like it's really not that big of a deal, but I could see for somebody who's been in a larger accident, had a very serious spinal injury, that this could this could really transform how they live, right?
Yep, of course. Now, from our clinical data, so we run a clinical trial in the US and we just wrap it up last year. So from the data we have seen, we saw some of the our users, right, or the participants of a clinical trial, they were able to, you know, open the door, you know, eat or pour water by themselves before they received the treatment that we delivered.
So wait, so they regained the not only sensation, but they regained mobility.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. So somebody whose arm was not working, they could potentially have regained some movement in the arm.
Yeah. For patients with spinal cord injury, yes. So wow. I kind of remember that last year, right, when we got our CE mark, we have one of the prestigious hospital in Germany to try our product, okay? So they got a patient from Ukraine, okay? And that patient has C3 complete spinal cord injury. And he went to the hospital to receive a treatment 2 or 3 weeks after his injury. So I, based on the video or the data we've seen, after 3 weeks, he was able to use a fork to, you know, eat cake by himself.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a way to celebrate with a little bit of cake, huh?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Boy, are there other treatments that have this type of impact where you can restore sensation and mobility? This sounds pretty unique.
This question is kind of related to the regulatory indication as well. So in the Europe, I think our product is the only system or device that can be used to restore the upper extremity functions for patients with complete, incomplete, traumatic, non-traumatic, chronic, acute, subacute, all subtypes or stage of ACI patients in the Europe. Okay. But in the US, we are only allowed to treat patients with incomplete spinal cord injuries and only, you know, got indication to focus on hand sensation and strength.
Okay. So there are more constraints and narrower, you know, scope of what you can do in the US for now, but that might expand as you keep going.
Right.
Well, that's really impressive from a technological standpoint. It has to be kind of exciting to be able to take something like this from your mind into reality and see doctors, you know, helping patients like measurably, like visibly improve their quality of life. That's got to be a very rewarding part of the job.
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind the scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face, long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential. So we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
Of course, it is. So, and Jeff, I forget to mention to you that actually the reason why we need to kind of move our podcast one day, is because I was in one of our clinic yesterday. So I went there to see how our clinician use our product to treat 5 patients. So starting from 10 o'clock to 5:30 or 5 wow. 5 o'clock p.m. So many of them were the first time users. So some of their family member were with us yesterday. So I saw that one or two of the patients, right, when we use our product, right, we call SSDM to deliver stimulations, many of them are able to increase their hand strength immediately, and they're able to pinch like this, much way better than just 2 or 20 minutes before they receive the treatment.
And then it's that fast?
Yes. So we know that the product, right, it has both therapeutic effect and also prosthetic effect. So now, if we continue to use a product or this receive the stimulation, we notice that patient improved. But we also discovered that while the stimulation is on, the patient can actually perform better.
So it continues to improve the longer that they're using the device. But you can see, but in 20 minutes you can go from limited or no mobility to some mobility that quickly.
We saw that when the stimulation is on, the patient can perform better. So I wouldn't say that from no mobility to some mobility. I would say if the patient got some improvement already, right, and he continued to receive stimulation, and then when the treatment is delivered in real time, we see obvious change or improvement.
Yeah, I guess I should be careful. I'm not trying to overstate what you've been regulatorily approved for here in the United States.
Thank you, Jeff. So
I'm simply trying to understand, and I'm impressed. I'm impressed with what you're doing. So I really appreciate you sharing that.
No problem.
I'm clearly you and your team are very technologically capable. How big is your team, by the way?
I think we have around 18 people.
Okay, all very smart, I'm sure. At the technology and doing stuff. What has it been like for you as because you probably started on this as you probably defined and started to solve the problem, brought team members on. But as you've grown with 18 people, a team of 18 people is, it's more than just one person working on a problem. You now have a team, you have to start thinking about managing the culture of the team or bringing money in to pay the team. And what is the evolution been like for you as you go from maybe strictly engineering and research and technology into more of a leadership?
I'm kind of thinking about what I did in the past from the beginning.
How long do you think it took for you to get to the point where you said to yourself, I think I need to, you mentioned at one point you got a coach, right? And so at what point did you say to yourself, the team has been working fine, we're making progress on the technology, but I think I could do some more business side of things. I think I could be more of a CEO or a mentor. When did that happen?
So that happened probably after 8 or 9 months. When I started the company, and now I do remember the triggering point for that is, at that time we got a very talented engineer who was with Intel at that time. Okay, very smart guy, and he can solve a lot of challenging problems. And then all of a sudden, after 8 or 9 months, he told me that he's going to quit, and he was going to quit, and he was going to start his own company. Okay, a different application, not related to medical device. At that time, I started to think about what did I do wrong, okay, how can I improve? And then, yeah. and then I start to, try to, get advice or help, how do I continue to improve and run the company? It's kind of a triggering point for us, to get the CEO coach at that time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's sometimes we have to get a little bit surprised by the situation or to realize, I probably need to spend more time on, the strategy or the team or the culture or the numbers. So I think a lot of CEOs go through that.
If I may, this one point I want to make. So in the beginning, right, as engineer or researcher, PhD, right, first PhD. So we are good at define problem, solve problems, right? But those are all probably not non-human related problems. So I'm really bad. I was really bad at handling human issues at that time, and that's why I have an urgent need, right, to find someone to teach me how to handle this.
Yeah. Well, I think as an engineer, I say this with love because I think a lot of engineers, we have a kind of a stereotype that people look at us and they say, you're really smart, you're really good with numbers, but people, not as much. And so, and while I think that's fair to a degree, I also think in my experience, having worked with a lot of different CEOs, there are a lot of people who might be really good with people, but maybe they're not very good with numbers. And numbers are also equally important when you're talking about, financial projections in the company. And so you really need to have a balance. And it's, of course, it's not just people and numbers. There's much more to it than those two factors. But, we've all got our skills and talents, and there's always room to improve in other areas. So I think it's actually commendable that, you saw so early on, hey, 9 months in after starting a company to say, I need some help. I need to get some coaching or mentoring. I think a lot of people don't do it that quickly. So it's commendable that you moved on that, on that thought so quickly.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So in the last 8 years, as you've grown the company, I know that there are some big milestones like getting your approvals in Europe and in the United States. But I'm curious, from as you look back, are there a couple moments where you ran into some really big obstacles and you said, we might not be able to get past this one? Some of those times, is there one or two that stand out where you were able to approach the problem, maybe reevaluate it, reflect on it, step back and get a new perspective, and then be able to come tackle the problem more effectively?
And Jeff, there are probably more than five.
So it's like one a year then, huh?
Yeah. It looks like we now have been taken on a roller coaster, right? Up and down, but down, many times, sometimes just took the roller coaster, ride in one or two times per month. But I think there are a few, moments or events, right? I do vividly remember until now. So I would say one of the interesting one is our clinical trial. Okay, so we did a gold standard clinical trial. Okay, so that people has not done before. Okay,
okay,
and then in order to reduce the regulatory risk, right? So we talked to the FDA, U.S. FDA. To get their opinion regarding our clinical trial design, okay, and it turns out that this conversation lasted 11 months.
Oh wow! Yeah, is this because the clinical trial design was so new, nobody had done it before, or?
Yeah, so because we are treating spinal cord injuries, right? There was no solution before. So basically, even we don't know how we don't know. I think probably it's the same for FDA. So the conversation lasted for 11 months, but as a small step, right? So we have we have to move fast. And after a few rounds of conversation or going back and forth communication, then we decided to launch our study. Even though we might not get their green light, but we were lucky. After we decided to launch the study, probably 2 weeks after, we got the green light from the FDA. So we took the risk. We did not have a further delay, and then we get what we need. Okay. I think that's one.
Yeah. How did that work with your team? Who was on your team at that point, and were they all Like, did it cause stress for the team that you're all just kind of waiting for the clinical trial, you know, proposal to be approved, or or was everybody busy? Like, how did the team manage that?
So they were stressed. They were very stressed because I told them I will have to. We will have to launch the study, right? We cannot keep waiting. But now they are a bit more conservative. They want to, you know, get more information, right, before we go in ahead to do the study, because this is not a cheap study, right? This study costed us like $7 to $8 million. So this is a big decision, right? And then, and this is a two years time frame, right? So if we make it wrong, it might easily waste 2 years and waste a lot of money.
And if and so, if you had done the study, I mean, that is a lot of money for a startup to put towards something. If you had done the study and then the FDA approval process took longer, or maybe even didn't come through for some reason, would that have just been wasted money in the end?
No, we just want to get more clarity, right, regarding our study design. So even if we didn't get it, I think we can still go ahead to do our submission. Yeah.
Okay, so it was still useful. It wasn't like a huge gamble, but it was a big commitment at that point in time.
Right.
How did you get your team on board with that?
After analyzing the risk and benefit, right, and also the cost of keep delaying the study, I think kind of we got everyone aligned. So we went ahead to launch the study and have a clear communication with our clinical PIs. At that time, I think we were running a clinical study at 14 prestigious research centers across the U.S. from East Coast to West Coast. So we got everyone aligned and then went ahead to launch the study.
I like that framing because I think for a lot of people, they would just see the first half of that where you say $8 or $9 million. That's a lot of money. That's a huge expense if we launch this study. And the way you just framed it added kind of the counterweight or the counterbalance to that, which is, yeah, but what is the cost if we don't launch it? There's also a really big cost if we don't launch the study, sort of an opportunity cost type of scenario. That might be backwards from opportunity cost, but you know, like you're adding the other half of the analysis that isn't always, you know, not everyone's necessarily thinking about the cost if we don't do it versus it's easy to see the cost if we do it.
Right. Yeah.
I like that. What's another time that you ran into kind of one of these moments?
Yeah. This one was even more challenging. So after we launched the study and executed the study for around 6 months, okay. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, everything's fine, product's fine, but all of a sudden we got product issues. Okay. So we got continued reporting or complaint from all our clinical sites, right? Our electro, there's some issue or quality issue with our electrodes. Okay.
How does that present itself? Because are you saying these are problems with the product that people are using?
So it's like the quality of the electrodes. So we rely on the external electrode to deliver stimulation, right? But we continue to receive a complaint from our clinical sites, okay?
So the electrode were like degrading in quality or something?
Yeah. So if electrode didn't work well, right? And then the patients could not receive effective stimulation. So basically, what the treatment they receive is useless. Okay. And at that time, we got our team to, a proposal, right, to post the study. Okay. And there was a very hard decision because we have a limited timeline, right, to finish the trial. But in the meantime, if we continue the trial and using these electrodes, right, with quality issues, but basically we are throwing the water, money into the water. Okay. So after debating, team with our team and do a lot of evaluation and think about the contingent plan, I think we eventually decided to pause the study for around 6 months.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Then we need to inform all the clinical PI, right? Tell them what we are doing now and also give them a date as to when we're going to restore the study. It's kind of challenging at that time because there were already some patients, right? They already arranged the time to join our trial.
They were ready, but then you had to say, no, hold on. Wait, is that common to pause a study like that? Does that happen often?
I don't have too much experiences. I don't know what others did that, but I think this is not, even for us, I don't think this is common. Yeah.
Okay. But it was. But it sounds like it was necessary, because if you didn't pause it, then the results were not going to be what you needed.
Yeah. Especially this, also good for us, right? I think good for us because, that eventually we still need to do commercialization, right? So it's better to know the problem earlier, whether that's a process, design, vendors, or whatever, right? So it's good to discover the root cause in the beginning.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. I'm curious, how did you, when you noticed this problem as a team and you debated, what do we do? Should we pause the study or not? It seems to me like maybe one of the more critical parts of this story is how you guys decided to communicate pausing the study to the clinics that were participating and the actual participants themselves. How did you navigate that conversation and that type of communication?
Thinking about this again, right? This was not ever easy. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think one thing that we always keep in mind is we have to be transparent. Okay. To let this clinical PI know what was going on at that time. Okay. And then make it very clear that this is how we are going to handle that, our solution, and also give them a expected timeline, so they know what is going to happen, and then so that they can plan on their side too. So I think it's kind of how we manage that.
Did that, and I don't know the details here, but I'm curious, when you pushed pause on the study and you communicated it, I assume they all, said, well, if that's what it has to be, then we understand. But did that leave patients that were in the middle of the study? Did they have to discontinue the study and then pick it back up later?
No, for those patients who were already in their studies, I think we have them to continue the trial.
Yeah, okay.
But we just stop recruiting patients, right?
Post-recruiting
new patients.
Okay. I was going to say, it would be really difficult for somebody who's seen that type of improvement in their quality of life, even during the study, have to be paused. So that makes a lot more sense now that you've explained it that way. In the end, what did, do you feel like pausing the study helped you come out better than if you hadn't paused? I'm sure that's why you made the decision to do it. But what was the result of pausing it? How did it change what you were able to achieve?
I think we figure out the root cause. Okay, we fix a problem. Okay, and we also through this process, right? We also learn a lot as to what kind of vendor that we should work with. So this is not a single problem. Right? It's a problem mixed with multiple issues. So we're able to identify different issues and try to work on that and improve it. Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah, it sounds like maybe the quality of vendors or something might have been an issue. One of the things I love when I've worked with inventors and people innovating new things and creating new businesses around them is that these types of problems, and they're real problems, right? You see this and someone says to you, hey, we got a problem with the electrodes, and you're like this is a big deal. While nobody wants to deal with the problem, the fact that the problem exists oftentimes is also the reason that some new inventions are created, right? Because we say, well, what do we do? And I don't know in your case if you just had to find a new vendor, or if you had to, redesign the electrodes, or if you, created software programming to control it. I love that engineers and innovators can take these problems, perhaps in a slightly less emotional way sometimes, and look at them as the problem and then start to find solutions. Did you guys find that this created other innovation opportunities for you too?
So the short answer is of course. I would say every crisis is opportunity, right? So we not only identify the root cause, I think that lead us to our next generation of electropad, right? That resolve the issues, the fundamental issues, but also can reduce the manufacturing cost. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then that also, kind of, force us to improve the solution, not only from hardware side. We also try to improve the solution from the software firmware. So we always, solve the problem from multiple aspects instead of just one single brute force solution.
Yeah. I like that. Well, this is fascinating, Yikai. I'm really glad that you're sharing this with us. And it makes me wonder, you've been doing a lot of stuff for 8 years now. You're starting to get, we'll call it traction, right, with approvals and things like that. Where do you see this going in the next 3 to 5 to 8 more years?
So now we got our FDA clearance. Okay. And then just before the FDA clearance, I think in February, we also close our Series C financing. Okay.
Nice.
So the next 3 to 5 years, I think our goal is very clear, right? So we have to focus on commercialization, okay, to sell our product in EU and US market, okay, as much and as fast as we can. But we also have to make sure that we are delivering quality product and service to those patients in need, right? We are not just trying to scale in a very unreasonable way. We want to make sure that we will provide quality, okay, to those users too. And then the second one is we are not just building a simple product, we are building a platform. So during the following few years, we are expecting that we can expand our platform to cover other indications to treat a wide array of patients instead of limited to spinal cord injuries. But spinal cord injury itself is already a tough and challenging problem to solve.
That sounds like there's a lot of green field ahead of you, a lot of ability to go and continue to innovate. I love that. And my last question for you before we end here, as a leader, what do you think is the quality that you'll take with you and continue to develop and apply during these coming years?
I'm not sure about the quality, but I think what I learned right through this process that I will for sure bring with me is I have to build the right team at the right stage, right at the right timing, and get the right people. I think by keeping this in mind, many of these people issues or technical issues probably can resolve by having the right team at the right time and the right structure. I think I will keep doing this in the future.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I know a lot of other CEOs who are building businesses are doing, they see similar issues. They might be different fields of technology, but they see similar issues, and even maybe in different orders. But by hearing, experiences like yours and insights like you've gained, it helps other CEOs know that they can tackle a problem and maybe even know how to tackle a problem. So thank you for sharing that experience with us.
Probably my pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
It's been a pleasure having you on, Yikai. And to our audience who's joined us today, thanks again for listening to The Breakout CEO.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.